This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The rumors swirled for months, and the deal was finally announced yesterday. IBM's fabrication plant in Essex Junction will be taken over by the microchip manufacturer GlobalFoundries. Governor Peter Shumlin was front and center yesterday morning, touting the deal as good news for Vermont.
Well, this is a real affirmation to the extraordinarily talented workforce at IBM. GlobalFoundries is in the chip-making business. Both research and development will remain in Vermont. Manufacturing will remain in Vermont. And this is their core business. There's been uncertainty for years about IBM's commitment to this particular part of the business. And so it's really good news for our workforce, good news for hardworking Vermonters.
The plant in Essex has a major presence in the state's economic picture. That's partly why there's been so much hand-wringing and close monitoring over the years as layoffs cut employment there by half. IBM's corporate fortunes are also on the decline. Tech analyst Peter Cohen explains part of what's dragging down IBM.
And IBM is shrinking in a growing market. They're following other people who have taken the lead, and IBM is trying to play catch-up. So it's hard to see profitable industries where IBM is a leader, and it's just so complex, and I don't think that the different pieces are benefiting from being part of the same company.
GlobalFoundries, for its part, sent us a statement saying, quote, "While IBM is exiting this business, GlobalFoundries sees an opportunity to continue to operate these facilities as part of our growing global operations. We have not made any long-term decisions about the future of these facilities, but GlobalFoundries will operate the plants for the foreseeable future." Well, today on the program, we're going to look at the deal between IBM and GlobalFoundries, where these two companies fit into the constantly changing tech sector, and what this all means for Vermont's economy and employment at the Essex plant. Tim McQuiston is the editor of Vermont Business Magazine, and he's followed the shifts at IBM for years. Tim, welcome back to the program.
Jane, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So let's talk a little bit about the details of this plan. We heard a lot about them yesterday, but just to recap for people who are unclear, it's not exactly a sale of the semiconductor
business. Someone laughed at me for calling it a sale because they're giving GlobalFoundries not only the entire business, including the patents, which is really interesting, but they're giving them $1.5 billion in cash. And it's hard to explain that. I was talking with an IBM employee who went to the town meeting the other day, yesterday, and he felt like, well, you're giving, not only you're giving it away, but you're giving them $1.5 billion to take us away. It kind of makes me feel worthless, you know. But IBM is trying to get out of the manufacturing business in all phases, and this is just part of that. And they had to make a decision. You know, they can't just mothball the plant or that whole operation. The plant in East Fishkill, which has about the same level of employment as we have here in Vermont, about 4,000 employees, 4,000 or 5,000 employees, because of they have these contracts. They have private contracts. They have foundry contracts. They have Department of Defense contracts with the federal government. So they can't just like close it. There's nowhere else to go. They'd be sued. It'd be a horrible mess. So they had to make a decision on what could they swallow. And they GlobalFoundries said $2 billion several months ago. IBM said $1 billion. So it's pretty obvious they split the difference on what the total was going to be. Now, the interesting thing is, and one of the questions is this the best case scenario for Vermont? And maybe it is. Maybe it is. Maybe the life of this plant, GlobalFoundries saying, yes, we're going to be committed to this plant, to these workers for the foreseeable future. Now, what is that?
That's
future?
That's a pretty nebulous term.
Yeah. And they were throwing out to the press and to the employees, they were talking 10 years. Now, maybe that is the best case scenario. Maybe 10 years is the most we could hope for a plant of this age. You know, the thing goes back to 1957.
Well, and 10 years is the deal that they've also struck with IBM to continue supplying chips for IBM, the GlobalFoundries will be making now from these plants,
sure,
right? Yeah. So that sort of makes sense then for the
server business and that sort of thing. So I think that's just sort of a ballpark. One of the questions is, well, why doesn't GlobalFoundries just add on to their plant in Malta, New York? Well, that's really, really expensive to do. It would take time. You have all these contracts. The Vermont plant is profitable. Let's face it. It's paid for. It already has the security features, has all the infrastructure. It's ready to go. There's nothing they have to do. They don't put really a lot of money into keeping the business going.
And it has trained workers.
It's trained workers. That is the idea. Everybody's on board. There's going to be some changes, obviously, in the pay and the benefits for the people. But that aside, there's a lot of work to be done. And in fact, the governor and IBM itself and Global Foundries say, you know, there's too much capacity. They can't produce everything in Vermont. They have to outsource some of it to France, to a plant in France. So there's a lot of work there and a lot that can be done. But I think, let's face it, at some point, there's going to be something new is going to have to happen in Essex Junction. It's just not going to be a chip plant forever as is. And we'll have to see what Global Foundries does. But maybe this is the best case scenario. I'd say, Jane, also, you know, as I was talking with people and they say, well, how do people feel? Well, it feels like you go to the doctor, you have aches and pains. It's like, oh, geez, you're really nervous. You go into the doctor, you finally have a diagnosis. And there's relief there. And there's this relief in the government and amongst the employees. But then you have the prognosis, and what's that going to be? So I call it nervous optimism. You know, mm-hmm. there's this hopeful, oh, maybe this will be good for several years. And I think that's, you know, the hopeful part of it. I do know that the governor and his staff were taken by surprise on the timing of this. It came quicker. Obviously, Global Foundries is not a surprise, but the right. timing of this was sort of like, you know.
Well, it was a little bit of hurry up and wait. I mean, people have been wondering about this for several months now. Would this deal happen? And it was
It looked dead for a little bit. And after the $1 billion deal, and then that fell apart. But apparently, the negotiations were ongoing, and you know, Global Foundries running big ads in the free press and opening that transition center in Williston. Apparently, that was a little bit of gamesmanship, a little bit of a feint. You know, it sounds like now Global Foundries knew they had this deal, and it was just a matter of what the price point was going to be.
We're talking today about the deal between IBM and Global Foundries, and we're getting the details on what is actually in that deal. We're also going to hear about this plant's role in the semiconductor industry at large. Listeners, if you have a question about what you've been hearing, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. If you're an IBM employee and want to share your more personal take on the news, you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Roger Kay is the principal of Endpoint Technologies Associates and contributor to Forbes.com. He's consulted for both IBM and Global Foundries, and he joins us now to put this deal in a broader context. Roger, welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
So IBM has been making its own chips. The plant that we're talking about that's making chips has been making them for IBM, and it's been losing money in that sector of its business. Can you actually take us into why that's a losing proposition for IBM when these chips are in so many products?
Right. Well, the problem is that the fabs are very expensive. And so if you don't have enough chips running through there, the cost per chip is higher than you can get for them when you sell them. And the problem is that IBM's volume has actually been declining over the years. It sells its own hardware, but that particular line has been under assault from competitors and has been declining a bit. And also, some of IBM's chips were used in game consoles up until recently with Nintendo and Sony and Microsoft, and it lost all three of those to Advanced Micro Devices, or AMD as some people know it, and so therefore its volume is way down. So the problem for IBM is it just wasn't putting enough volume through the factories to make money on those chips.
So getting rid of this sector was actually a good move, in your opinion?
Well, yeah. I mean, to just sort of slightly correct something that Tim said before, IBM lost $700 million last year on its semiconductor manufacturing operations overall, and it's basically been losing money on all of it for years. So they've had several billion dollars in the hole, and paying $1.5 billion to get out of losing billions more actually might be sort of a good deal for them. But they will continue, by the way, to manufacture systems. So they'll be buying chips made by Global Foundries and making their own systems in places like Canada and elsewhere. But, yeah, so in terms of that, the Global Foundries is in a position to blow the volume up on these chips. So basically they can make them, sell them to others, and in fact they believe that there's a lot of intellectual property that goes with the Vermont and New York plants that they can use elsewhere around the world, and they expect to expand manufacturing rather than contract it. So that should be good in the short term for Vermont, but also I think it will give an opportunity for Global Foundries to turn in a profitable processor line where IBM was unable to.
Tim, you wanted to jump in?
Well, I was going to say, Roger, that I was talking specifically about the Vermont plant and the Vermont operation, not the semiconductor, IBM's business semiconductor. And in total, when I was talking about the profitability, it's seen from here that the white elephant is the Fab 2000 plant down in East Fishkill, and that was the part of the business that was really dragging down. It seems to us, and correct me if I'm wrong, that this plant is doing pretty well right now. And what would you see as its future, and why not, and Jane and I were talking before, why wouldn't Global Foundries just add on to its Malta plant?
Well, you know, if you look at what goes into making a plant, the concrete is the least of it. Fabs used to cost $2 to $3 billion to make back about, let's say, 7 or 8 years ago. And I've recently seen a quote of $14 billion, and $10 billion is kind of the floor. And the difference is primarily the cost of the machinery. So ASML, for example, out of Netherlands, will charge $100 million for a lithography machine that it sells. You absolutely have to have for the latest processes. So the stakes in this particular game just keep rising. So if you look at a fab, what's important in there is the machinery and not so much the floor space. So if you look at the concrete in Malta, you say, well, we could probably shuffle some more machines over there. And in fact, they could do the same thing in Vermont. They could just sort of replace machines with new ones. That's what would be involved in updating the fab. And if you look at companies like Intel, which make chips for themselves for the most part, they have older fabs with older machines in them that they recycle from time to time. They mothball them occasionally. They update them. And that's what's really involved, is updating the machinery for the latest processes. So it's really going to be an investment on Global Foundries' part to keep the work in Vermont. And if you look at Global Foundries' strategy of manufacturing around the world, they've learned from cases like Thailand and others, where there have been earthquakes or hurricanes that have taken out tremendous areas all at once. They want to have diversified manufacturing geographically. So one good reason to keep a plant is just that it's somewhere else, and that's a good thing to have.
Roger Cato, do you see this industry continuing in the same manner that it has been, so that the plant in Essex is not only functional but profitable and useful to them moving forward in 10, 15, 20 years?
Well, yeah. I mean, just for example, take the Internet of Things that people have been talking a lot about. There's going to be 10 times as many chips out there, at least, maybe even 100 times as many chips, when that thing really gets going. Now, the chips themselves will not be worth that much. I mean, they'll be tiny little chips. They'll be $1 or $2 a piece when you buy them in bulk. But they'll go in everything, street lights and everything else you can think of. And so there'll be future semiconductor markets that Global Foundries customers will want to enter, and Global Foundries will be happy to service them in whichever of its plants. So in terms of its planning, it has to understand where these needs are coming from, anticipate them enough, get the machines on the floor, get them tooled up and ready to go for these new businesses, and then just keep going. And by the way, the skilled labor is very helpful. Folks who know how to operate these machines aren't that easy to train, and if they're all in one place and they've done this for years, that's a good thing. So I think that nexus of skill and just the physical plant is going to give Global Foundries a good excuse to keep investing in the area. So I would hope that they do that.
Tim, you had a thought.
Roger, I'm wondering, they're saying that this will close in June of 2015 or thereabouts. Is there any chance this won't come through? Is there some scenario in which this won't happen?
Well, there's a regulatory thing. They do need to go through some sort of review. I don't think that's going to be much of a problem. There's not a lot of obvious difficulty with it. Some people have said, well, Global Foundries is net owned by the government of Abu Dhabi, and that's not quite right. I mean, they own a lot of equity in it, and they've invested a lot in it, but the company itself is headquartered in California and is, I would say, it's an international company with a heavy U.S. flavor to it. So the question of, you know, will our authorities somehow look askance at that, and I think the answer is no.
Yeah, that's been a big question here, yeah.
Roger, before we let you go, doubling back here on IBM, which obviously has been looking to offload this part of its business and was willing to do so for a hefty price, although, as you point out, what they were losing would have been more. Does this put IBM in a better place now? A lot of analysts are seeing this company as struggling. Does this allow it to offload a part of its business that was really causing it to flounder and actually put it in a better place or not?
Well, yeah. I mean, IBM's long-term strategy is to try to migrate out of the commodity-like or money-losing areas, the old Rust Belt stuff, and move into the new areas, the high margin areas, the areas where it has some distinctive competence. An example is Watson. It's an incredible intelligent machine that can find all these answers that beats humans at Jeopardy and things like that. They're looking for ways to commercialize that. They haven't really found a big market there yet, but they've begun to have commercial test examples. And so that's beginning to go. Those are the areas that IBM wants to be in, the high margin areas. And this was obviously not a high-margin area, it was losing money on it, but I think this is somewhat of a special case. So, for example, it got rid of the x86 servers, its sort of Intel-style servers that it had. It had no advantage in that business, and so there was really no reason for it to be in that business. Other companies like Dell and Hewlett-Packard do the same thing. But in the area of Watson, for example, nobody has that. IBM has that alone. In the case of semiconductors, it just didn't have the volume to sustain the business. So it wants to get out of all of that sort of heavy stuff and into the lighter areas where it has an advantage. And it's been trying to do that for at least a decade, maybe closer to two decades. So it's just part of its long-term transition. There are some issues for IBM, which is it really expert in anything that nobody else does anymore? And the answer is, well, a few things. Its research and development is pretty advanced and so on, but that may not be enough to sustain a company the size of IBM, which is roughly $100 billion revenue per year, and I don't know if they can get all of that out of new businesses.
That's Roger Kay. He's the principal of Endpoint Technologies Associates Incorporated and a contributor to Forbes.com. He's also consulted for both IBM and GlobalFoundries. Roger, thanks very much for talking with us. Appreciate your time.
My pleasure, Jerry.
We're still talking with Tim McQuiston, editor of Vermont Business Magazine, about the IBM GlobalFoundries deal. You know, if what Roger is talking about, the future of IBM being uncertain, maybe this is the best thing for Vermont to be separate from IBM. We're going to put that question to Frank Coffey, executive director of the Greater Burlington Investment Corporation, coming right up. And listeners, we'd like to hear from you if you have thoughts on this deal, if you've been watching the news and think about how it might affect you, where you live or where you work, if perhaps you work in a field that supports the IBM workers. Tell us what you think. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're looking at the details of the IBM deal with GlobalFoundries for IBM's semiconductor business, which includes the fabrication plant in Essex, where about 4,000 Vermonters work. We've been getting the scoop from Tim McQuiston, editor of Vermont Business Magazine. Listeners, if you have a perspective to share on this situation, do give us a call. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. And we are hearing from lots of listeners who are sharing their perspective on this. Mark says, I'm sure Governor Shumlin is glad that he's not facing an imminent shuttering of the Essex plant at this point in the election season. It means he and his administration won't have to suffer the fallout of massive high-paying tech job losses on their watch and have to deal with the property tax question while rolling out a single-payer funding plan. Steve, though, asks, how long before Vermont's anti-business climate runs GlobalFoundries out of state to New York or overseas? We had posed listeners a question, does this news reassure you? And Elizabeth says, large corporations are many things. Reassuring is never one of them. So again, you can add your thoughts by going to vpr.net and clicking on Vermont Edition. We're also joined now by Frank Coffey, executive director of the Greater Burlington Industrial Corporation. Frank, nice to have you on the program.
Thanks, Jay.
So are you hearing from people around your region, whether they work at IBM or not, who are talking about this deal, and what are they telling you?
We're hearing from a lot of people. First of all, I think Tim did a great job summarizing the emotions behind it. It's been a long, hot, miserable summer, just not knowing what the future would hold, who we were dealing with. I guess for about the past year, we've known that that IBM wanted to sell this division of the IBM Corporation, and they actually hired Goldman Sachs to help them with that. So we have known for quite a while that they wanted to sell off this division. So there was a lot of uncertainty. And for us on the economic development side, not knowing who you're going to be dealing with is much different. So now we do know, and I think the governor said it well, that Global Foundries, and Roger Kay just said it, is an incredible company that that is very focused in the semiconductor and microelectronics business, that is investing very significantly globally, especially in our area and in the Albany, Malta, New York area. And they've shown a great commitment there. So for us in what we do in economic development, we have to be optimistic. And now we know who we're dealing with. And now we need to find out what it's going to take to keep them employing 4,000 plus people here in Vermont, because the people are number one to us, the Vermonters that work there. And then the investments are number two, because that creates more jobs in the multipliers effect, and subcontractors, suppliers, merchants, the whole Vermont economy. So now we know who we're dealing with. The governor had a meeting with the CEO yesterday, and I think he was very impressed with the CEO and had a really good conversation. And now the work begins of us finding out. I think, as Tim said and Roger said, it will be a number of months before the deal actually closes. If you saw the press conference yesterday, we basically had all of Vermont's political and governmental leadership there with the governor. They've all been in sync for months. Senator Leahy, Senator Sanders, Congressman Welch, Governor Shumlin, Lieutenant Governor, the Speaker of the House, President Pro Tem of the Senate. The good thing about Vermont is we may not be able to match checkbooks with big states and nations, but we are agile and we are very accessible, and that's what you'll see. And the workforce here at this IBM facility is second to none. They've always been the best in manufacturing.
Well, that workforce is certainly a valuable piece of this acquisition. But Tim McQuiston, we were hearing from Roger Kay earlier, who was suggesting that perhaps Global Foundries will want to keep this Essex plant in operation because of the equipment that they're buying and because they'll want some geographical diversity so that if one plant goes down, they have another place to operate it. Are you convinced that this Essex plant is going to stay in Global Foundries' portfolio for the long term? I mean, they're saying foreseeable future, but that's a pretty
nebulous. What's the long term in the internet world? You know, is 10 years could be a very long time. Frank said something very interesting. It'd be very easy for them to just to go along, keep making the chips as they do now, that they're going to these cell phones. And as Roger put it, this is a tremendously expanding market. There aren't going to be fewer chips. You know, there's a lot of fewer other things. There's not going to be fewer. There's going to be a lot more that there's going to be a need to produce. I think what Frank is suggesting, and I don't think they've exactly – they said, you know, they can maintain it. Are they going to invest here? And I think that would be the really big clue as to what their commitment really is to this plant and to Vermont. And we care about, as Frank said, the workforce the most.
Frank Coffey, is the area making plans for an eventual end to this industry or end to this plant in the same way that Southern Vermont and the Brattleboro area were trying to plan for what might happen in an eventual closure of Vermont Yankee? Is that something that you need to be thinking of regardless of what happens or what you know right now, just so that you're prepared for the future?
I think I don't think we're taking a fatalistic view. We definitely are taking a realistic view of what that campus means to this region and to the state. So it is a phenomenal piece of infrastructure, the entire campus. It's an industrial city. There's 3.5 million square feet of existing buildings there. All of the infrastructure is redundant. It has redundancy. So this is why you know, and Vermonters are very focused on smart growth and redevelopment. So this entire campus possesses the land and infrastructure assets for us to do a lot of things, especially on the Williston side of the campus. But right now we're focused on, if you will, we had our first date yesterday with Global Foundries, and now we're going to build a relationship.
Although not everybody's convinced about that relationship. We got a note from Scott who says Global Foundries has already stated that their plant in Malta will grow from 2,000 workers to 4,000 over the next few years. Now, Scott says three guesses where those jobs are going to come from and the first two don't count. Worse yet, if Global Foundries offers current IBM employees a job in their Malta facility and they don't accept it, Global Foundries doesn't have to pay unemployment. So Scott already worried about this deal.
Yeah. I have to be optimistic. And, you know, I have to look at what the assets are that we have here. And asset number one is the people and the people who have been so good at manufacturing and development for years. I know when IBM opened the plant in East Fishkill, it was Vermonters that had to go over and teach them how to manufacture. So in –
But Scott's worried about those workers. Are you telling him not to worry?
I think the workers, as anybody finds out in skilled industries today, that industry will go and invest where there's a competent and qualified workforce, and especially in advanced manufacturing and in services. Look at the dealer.coms of the world on their end of the industry scale. But in microelectronics manufacturing, we have always done it the best here. So I think, and as Tim said, we've been a profit center for IBM. We were not causing the bleeding. The bleeding was basically the East Fishkill site. So I'm optimistic that that we need to keep and maintain a very, very skilled workforce here, and that we do whatever we can do as a state to encourage sustained investment and future investment, so that I know our facilities here at the IBM campus can accommodate new equipment. And that's what we'll be seeking is new equipment.
Frank Coffey says he has to be optimistic. Tim, you don't.
Well, as a journalist, of course, I always look at the negative side of it. And I, you know, every industry that has ever existed has disappeared. You know, if you look at Springfield, the tooling industry disappeared. If you look at Rutland, the marble industry is a faint shadow of what it used to be. These things turn over. One of the reasons why GBIC actually was the lead in bringing IBM to Vermont to begin with is because the woolen mills in Winooski closed and thousands of people were laid off. So I think, you know, what Frank – and Frank did a very comprehensive report. I think it came out earlier this year, Frank, on this is a site that has tremendous opportunity even if it isn't a fabrication plant. And, you know, none of us want to think about, you know, that part of the industry closing here in Vermont and losing those jobs. But you have to think about that, and you have to think about, well, what makes sense in a global economy? IBM, who would have known that IBM wouldn't make computers? You know, 20 years ago, would you thought IBM is not going to make computers anymore? That would seem impossible. So you do have to keep this in the back of your mind. What's going to be good? You can just do what you can. In Vermont is pretty limited on the money scale compared to New York State, which is willing to throw tens of millions of dollars at these things. And, you know, that's why I call it sort of nervous optimism. You know, when I was at that press conference yesterday with the governor and Frank and many others, everyone seemed a little bit nervous trying to put a brave face on everything. And that's part of what I guess you have to do as a development official is look at the bright side of it.
We're talking today about the deal between IBM and Global Foundries. We're getting some details on the deal. We're hearing from Tim McQuiston, who's been covering this as editor for Vermont Business Magazine for a long time. Also talking with Frank Coffey, who's executive director of the Greater Burlington Industrial Corporation. And let's talk first with Joy here, who's on the line with us from Colchester. Hi, Joy. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. I guess the question I was wondering is that it's my understanding that the IBM plant makes current technology, current chips. I don't know if I know nothing about chips, but I think it's a 200-millimeter chip, and that Global Foundries and in general is making the next generation chip. So we're going to be having scanners, different technology that we probably can't even imagine right now, that is going to be facilitated by the next generation of chip.
Yeah, Joy, go ahead. You had a question about that. Oh, I think
well,
we've
that's
lost.
What I'm wondering.
Yeah. So, what
is
about
FBI,
that, Frank Coffey? Do you
will
know?
Will IBM become obsolete because of the chip technology that is current in our 4G phones and so on, but that the next generation is coming out of the Malta plant?
Yeah, that's right. So just to recap here what Joy's talking about, the microchips that we're talking about come in two different sizes. There's 200 millimeter and 300 millimeter, and the Malta is a 300, and the Essex plant is a 200, and who knows in the future. So, Frank, what about that idea that, you know, things are getting right. bigger and we're moving ahead?
The millimeter means the size of the wafer, basically. So 200 millimeter is an 8-inch wafer. And a 300 millimeter, which is what East Fishkill does, is 12-inch. And GlobalFoundries is doing that, and they're even doing, they're going to be doing larger. That speaks to volumes. And so the core customers here have been in the cell phone and mobile handheld markets. And generally what will happen is it takes about, just so you understand, the R&D side and then the making of the chip and how long a chip has utility for, just think of your cell phone. It takes them about 10 months to 12 months to design a chip. Say it needs to be cooling or doing some different functions. And then typically they'll get about 2 years run out of that chip. So the cycle is maybe a 2 to 3 year cycle. And what the scientists have done here and the innovators have done here is they've figured out a way continually to work with the technologies they do to produce the highest value-added chip to service the markets they're in. So I don't care what cell phone or handheld device you have today, there's at least one chip that's made, designed and made right here in Vermont. So what the future means, and when Joy's talking about GlobalFoundries doing the highest form of technology. They're probably making chips for server farms and other more complicated computing devices and storage, which is what Fishkill was doing as well. Our markets today are different. There's still 3-inch wafer sites in the world. There's 5-inch wafer sites in the world. There's 8-inch wafer sites in the world that are very productive. That said, we want new investment here. And we will, as a state, we'll seek that. I know the governor will be focused on that.
And that's what Tim has been talking about, this idea of if we see some investment, that might make a sign that GlobalFoundries wants to stay here. I want to make sure we get in another call here.
Sure.
We have Martha Maxim, who's on the line with us. She's executive director of the United Way of Chittenden County. Hi, Martha. Nice to talk with you.
Hi. Thank you for having me. Hi, everyone. I also just wanted to add sort of a perspective about IBM and its impact on the local economy through the lens of the extraordinary charitable giving that has been made by employees and the corporation in Chittenden County and in Vermont over the tenure of IBM being here. It is in the tens of millions of dollars of money that has been donated by IBM employees and by the corporation to support the nonprofit sector in Vermont. Also, the extraordinary volunteerism of IBM employees. They are out and about in our community all the time doing dozens of hours of volunteer time as well. And it's just an incredible value to the nonprofit sector. And I just really wanted to express gratitude and acknowledgement that this is another piece of the IBM impact on our community. It's pretty extraordinary.
Martha, thanks for the call. Appreciate that. And Tim McQuiston, I'll go to you here for the end. I think there is this sense, we're not losing the workers, but we are losing IBM. And this has been an IBM town. There must be some sense of sort of bittersweet farewell in that.
Oh, absolutely. IBM has been a great corporate partner to Vermont. And globally, it's a great company. Now, the cynicism of the last couple of years where they're getting rid of senior people, that has left some bitterness in a lot of people's mouths. But IBM has bigger problems. In fact, in the New York Times this morning, I looked at it, and they didn't even mention the sale of the chip business because IBM came out with a really bad third quarter report.
Yeah, so we'll remain to be seen. Maybe it's a, as you said, maybe it's a good thing for Vermont.
Well, we'll see. Yes, hopefully Frank will find that out.
Yes, absolutely. Tim McQuiston is the editor of Vermont Business Magazine. Frank Coffey is executive director of the Greater Burlington Industrial Corporation. Thanks very much to both of you for being on the program.
Thanks, Jane.
Thank you, Jane.
And VPR will be continuing to follow this story. Check back to VPR.net for updates as it unfolds. Coming up, the state's attorney general's office has released draft rules for GMO labeling. We'll find out what they propose and why the AG is inviting public scrutiny. That's next on Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Last spring, the legislature passed a law requiring foods that contain genetically modified organisms, GMOs, to be labeled. The details of how that labeling would work were left up to the Attorney General. The AG's office has just released an early draft proposal of the GMO labeling rules, and the office is holding meetings around the state this week to give manufacturers, farmers, grocers, and regular citizens a chance to take a sneak peek. Yesterday, I talked with Assistant Attorney General Todd Delos, who worked on the new rules, to get a sense of what's in them.
There are two different labels that are going to be out there. The first is for raw agricultural commodities, which is really what we think of as produce in the grocery store. And those are going to be labels that will be on every sign that identifies the produce and every sign that gives the price of the produce. And it'll say produced with genetic engineering, if in fact the produce is produced with genetic engineering. The other sign, and I think this is where a lot of people are interested in the direction, will be on packaged foods. So those are packaged processed foods. It could be juice. It could be canned goods. It could be frozen goods. And what we have recommended or what we're proposing is a disclosure on the label about the size of where it says serving size on the nutrition facts label that already exists on most of these foods. And that disclosure then would say produced with genetic engineering or maybe produced with genetic engineering or partially produced with genetic engineering. So it's got to be big enough that people can read it easily. It can't, you know, blend in with the background.
Right. You can't be the same color as the package.
Exactly. We're not telling producers and manufacturers where they have to put that label. What we're saying is, if you want to be in compliance with the law, you're going to put it on the same panel, the same part of the package, where the nutrition facts label and the ingredients list already live, so that somebody who's interested in getting this information knows where to look. It's easy to find. But it's not a warning. It's nothing like that. It's just information for consumers and people who are interested in knowing this before they make a purchase.
So at least in theory at this point, what somebody would do who wants to know would be to go to the panel where all of the ingredients lists are and the vitamins and the calories and what nutrients are in it and would try to find there a label that says may be produced with genetic engineering or is produced with genetic engineering.
Exactly.
Partially.
Or partially. There are three. That's exactly right. Our thought process has been that's where people look for information about what's in the product. And this is just factual information about how the product was produced. And that seems to be the most logical place.
So what would the verification process be? And how are we determining which label is being put on the food and if there needs to be a label at all?
Well, those are two different and important questions. The first about verification, this is one of the means by which a producer could show that their product does not contain something with GE. So folks who have been to, really almost any grocery store, but certainly the natural foods markets have seen the non-GMO project labels. The non-GMO project is an example of a third-party verification. What the law, Act 120, does and what our rules implement or propose to implement is creating a system by which those third parties could apply to the Attorney General's office to be approved to verify for producers out there. So the verification process really is looking at third parties that run a product through a series of tests. They're testing for the presence of GE material. They're ensuring that there's segregation between GE and non-GE material through the food chain, the food system, and also ensuring that they can trace the food back. That's what verification does. The other piece about what label goes on what food, when a food is required to be labeled because it contains an ingredient that's produced with genetic engineering, the producer has to label it, and any label has to say produced with genetic engineering. That said, a producer can modify that phrase by saying partially produced with genetic engineering or maybe produced with genetic engineering. In order to be able to say partially, a producer would have to show that the product doesn't contain more than 75% material produced with genetic engineering. If it's more than that, then it just is produced with genetic engineering. The other option is maybe, and a producer can only use that modifier if they don't actually know whether or not their product contains genetic engineering. So this may be a circumstance where a producer is a small-scale producer, receives inputs from a lot of different manufacturers, and doesn't know whether their corn syrup is or is not GE, but there's a pretty good likelihood it is. And so to be on the safe side of the labeling, they go ahead and label it maybe produced with genetic engineering. And it doesn't enable producers to just turn a blind eye to their sources, but it also doesn't require them to exhaustively search back all of the chain of tracing their food back all the way to the fields.
The verification process, it verifies products that are GMO-free, that don't have GE ingredients. But the label identifies products that do have those ingredients. So if a company doesn't get the verification that its products are GMO-free, will they have to have a label that says it may contain GMOs, even if the company thinks the product was not made with genetically modified ingredients? If they haven't gone through that third-party verification process, will they automatically have to have a label?
I think that's a good question. What you want to imagine is a scenario. Let's say I made tomato sauce, a very simple tomato sauce. Though there is a variety of GE tomato out there. In general, tomatoes aren't GE, and perhaps I know what the sources of my ingredients are, and I know that I'm producing a product that it just doesn't contain GE. I don't have to label it then. Where the labeling occurs is when someone is offering a food for retail sale in Vermont that contains food produced with genetic engineering, and that means that they know that the food contains GE materials. In the scenario you suggest, you wouldn't have to get verified. I mean, another option would be to get a certification, a sworn statement from the person who sold you the ingredient.
Like the farmer, maybe.
Maybe it's the farmer, maybe it's the miller. And that's enough for you to rely on to say, well, that cornmeal was not, in fact, produced with genetic engineering, or this tofu.
So in that case, you're not going through the process and all of the requirements and the cost of getting a third-party verification from a place like the Non-GMO Project, but you're getting a sworn statement, and that would be enough under Vermont law to say to that producer, you don't have to put a label on.
Yes, and I would say another piece of this under the verification rubric that we're recommending in our draft rule is that if something is certified organic by an organization accredited by the National Organic Program, that organic certification is sufficient verification of the food being GE-free.
But, you know, the organic label brings up that interesting counterpoint, and, you know, I won't belabor this for too long, but when you look at foods in the grocery store that are organic, that have gone through that certification, the label says this is organic. By requiring companies to prove that they don't have genetically engineered ingredients, you know, you're sort of putting the onus on the producers who don't have them to prove that they don't have them when the label is for products that do have them. Is there no way to put the onus on people who do have GE ingredients just to prove that?
Well, I mean, I think that ultimately that is where the onus lies. Folks who are not producing food genetic engineered components are not required to label it. Ultimately, it's just the producers who are choosing to use ingredients produced with genetic engineering, who are choosing to produce food produced with genetic engineering, who are required to label.
Except for that may be produced part. If I don't know and I don't have the funds or the wherewithal to go through to find out whether I have genetically engineered ingredients or not, then I, as a food producer, would have to have that label may be produced with genetic engineering, if there's any possibility.
It's a little tricky to parse it without the specific facts, but what I would say is the knowledge threshold is the same whether you have to label and whether you choose may be produced. So the scenario I imagine for may be produced is, you know, I make potato chips and I fry them in cottonseed oil. And I make small batches and sometimes I run out of, and cottonseed oil tends to be a genetically engineered crop. And so I run out of cottonseed oil at some point and I switch over to grapeseed oil or another kind of oil that is not produced with genetic engineering, so that there's a possibility that a different batch of my potato chips will not, in fact, be produced with genetic engineering. That's a circumstance where it would be appropriate for my bag. Again, I'm a small-scale producer. I don't produce a new bag for every batch of chips that I make. That bag might say maybe produced with genetic engineering because I can't guarantee that it is or it isn't in any given run.
Todd Delos is an assistant attorney general. He's been telling us about the early draft of what Vermont's GMO labeling might look like. The AG's office is holding informal meetings on the draft this week. The first one happened today in Burlington. There's another meeting tomorrow, Wednesday, at 5 p.m. in Montpelier, and one on Friday at 3:30 in Brattleboro. Details are at vpr.net. Click on Vermont Edition. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to speak with Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott. He's running for his third term as Vermont's second in command, and he's the highest ranking Republican in the state. We'll get his take on single payer health care, education funding, and how to stimulate the Vermont economy. And if you have a question for Phil Scott, you can send it to vermontedition@vpr.net. Then listen tomorrow at noon. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.